big night for Biden.
It's a good night. And it seems to be getting even better.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and today on The Takeaway for March 4th, we'll talk Super Tuesday turnout and who made the difference. Also on the show, abortion rights are front and center at the Supreme Court.
Admitting privileges laws sound like common sense, but what it really does is it actually ends up shuttering clinics.
Plus, our ongoing 2020 census coverage brings us to tribal communities.
By the time 2010 rolled around, people in this part of the world simply were not interested in filling out census forms. We are finding that that is still the case, perhaps even more so.
Lots to get to, plus your takes. Let's get moving.
We need to bring everybody along. Everybody.
It's a good night! It's a good night! And it seems to be getting even better!
We won
Minnesota because of Amy Klobuchar. And we're doing well in Texas because of Beto O'Rourke.
What we need is a new politics that brings working class people into our political movement. One of us led the opposition to disastrous trade agreements, and that's me. When we began this race for the presidency, everybody said it couldn't be done.
The press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead. And then came South Carolina, and they had something to say about it. And we're told, well, when it got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy.
Tuesday's gone with the wind.
Super Tuesday results are in. Joe Biden is on top. He won 10 of the 14 states that were in play. Bernie Sanders won 4 states, including California. Mike Bloomberg won American Samoa and then dropped out of the race today, giving his endorsement to Joe Biden. All of which means the shape of the race for the Democratic nomination is finally coming into focus. Black and Latinx voters across the country are a big part of that focus. Amy Walter is here to help us understand what it all means. She hosts Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway and is also national editor at Cook Political Report. Great to have you here, Amy.
Hey, Duarte. Thanks for having me.
And Adam Harris is also with us. He is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Adam, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be here.
So, Amy, it was such a big night for Joe Biden. Where do we begin?
I know, right? Well, Adam and I were just saying before we got on air, what a crazy ride this primary has been from beginning to end. I mean, in some ways, we kind of have ended up where we began, well, what, a year ago, with the two best known folks with the biggest political brands, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, as the two candidates really left standing for the nomination here. They both represent very different elements of the Democratic Party. But I think what we learned last night are a couple of things. The first is that Democrats have been telling us in polls, in person, in focus groups, that the one thing that matters more than anything to them is that Democrats nominate somebody who can beat Donald Trump. And they've been twisting themselves in knots trying to figure out who the most electable candidate is, because every single candidate has flaws. There is no such thing as a perfect candidate. And as Sanders started racking up victories, and as he won especially big in Nevada, there was concern among so many Democrats that Sanders would not be able to win, and more important, would not just lose the presidency, but his presence on the top of the ticket would threaten control of the House, Democratic control of the House. And so Democrats, both the elected officials and the voters, decided, well, we got to rally about around the only thing we have left that looks electable, the only person who can kind of bring along a more diverse coalition, somebody who can win younger voters, or at least older voters, moderate voters, Black voters, and that's Joe Biden. And the other thing I want to point out that this evening told us is the importance of Donald Trump. I talked about electability, but Joe Biden went into the Super Tuesday with no money, no organization, and he was able to pick up states where he literally had not set foot. Yes, his name ID has something to do with it. Everybody knows who Joe Biden is. But Donald Trump is the best unifier and is the get-out-the-vote motivator for Democrats. Democrats want to beat Donald Trump. If you say you're the candidate who can beat Donald Trump, that's enough for them to vote for you.
So, Adam, you know, as Amy mentioned, there's all this talk about people of color and how they factor into this election. Did Biden do well with black voters?
Well, Jim Clyburn actually might be the most powerful person in politics right now, because it was really, you know, you saw Joe Biden fading with some of his black support in South Carolina ahead of Super Tuesday. And then he gets this Clyburn endorsement, who's the House majority whip. And, you know, all of a sudden, he gets this surge in South Carolina, right? 47% of people are saying that this endorsement is very important to their decision, or is at least important to their decision making. And, you know, that leads to a, you know, 60% advantage in South Carolina among black voters. That translates into a 60% advantage in North Carolina and Virginia among black voters. And, you know, those kind of sizable kind of, that's his starting base, right? You know, when you have that chunk of the electorate, that is a, you know, that's something you can build off of. But what the interesting thing that started to emerge was that, you know, he was turning out more voters than 2008, right? You know, you see increased turnouts in Virginia, you see increased turnouts in South Carolina. And these are states that are going to be, well, between Virginia and North Carolina, I should say, these are going to be states that are critical to winning in November. One of his lines last night during his speech, he's getting more elated and he's shouting and he's saying, you know, it's increased turnout and they turned out for us, right? So his argument is that not only am I electable, but I am getting people to turn out. And as Amy said, they're turning out because they believe that this is a person who might be able to defeat Donald Trump in November because of the kind of coalition that he's building between black voters, between suburban white voters, between white non-college educated voters. It's kind of the kind of coalition that they need to win in November.
And what about Latino voters? Any patterns emerging?
So you did see, at least in California, the early results were showing that about 80% of young Latino voters were swinging for Bernie Sanders. So that's a population where it's going to be, that's a heavy Sanders population. But Biden has historically been able to at least win some of that population, right? So if you're looking at Texas, it's going to be your older Latino voters who are going to swing more towards Biden. And generally, it's going to be more of your older voters who are swinging towards Biden. But it'll be interesting to see kind of as we're moving forward in this primary process where it's really a two-man race, kind of who is able to continue to hold on to those voters, if Sanders is able to continue to speak to those voters. In places like Florida, places like New Mexico and Arizona, whether or not that's a constituency that he can hold on to.
Mm-hmm. Amy, according to exit data, many voters appear to have changed their minds in just the last few days. Mm-hmm. What do we know about that? Is that typical?
No. The fact that this race literally turned on its heel in 3 days is something that most of us who cover politics you just don't see that. To me, the best example of this was Maine, a place where, again, according to the exit polls, for folks who said, no, I'd made up my mind who I was going to vote for earlier, you know, like within the last week or 2 weeks or last month or so, Sanders was winning those voters by something like 32 points. For the people who said they made up their mind in the last week, Biden won them by 22. So if things were going, and Colorado is a great example of this. Colorado was sort of like, I don't know, you know how you have those things that are trapped in amber, right? Like fossils trapped in amber. Colorado is a good sort of stand-in for amber because it's a vote-by-mail state. So most people voted before they learned about all these endorsements of Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and all of this. And that's where Bloomberg also did much better than anywhere else. So you could sort of see this is where the race probably would have been, with Bernie Sanders ahead, Bloomberg getting a good chunk of the vote, and Biden getting a fine but not really impressive showing in that state. You know, if every one of those states had voted on Friday instead of Tuesday, well, we'd be looking potentially at a, and this is why many of us were saying this, that Sanders was going to build a delegate lead that was going to be all but impossible for Biden to catch.
So just that single day or two made such a significant difference.
It did. The other thing to remember about this moment that we're in, and as we said, this is really exceptional, but actually it's kind of par for the course at this very volatile political time that we're in. If we go back to 2016 and think about what turned the tide in 2016, especially in the general election, were those late-breaking voters, especially in those upper Midwest states, who had said to pollsters for months, I hate both of these candidates. I don't like Trump. I don't like Hillary Clinton. But they broke overwhelmingly at the very end for Donald Trump. And it was that movement in such a big number that put Trump over the top.
So, Adam, you know, just as a side note, I mean, there were reports of issues at polling places in California and Texas yesterday. What do we know about that?
So one of the things that's kind of been glaringly apparent from 2016 to now is that this idea of voter suppression is going to be a big element, right, where you have lines where someone's waiting up to 7 hours to vote. That's its own kind of voter suppression. There were reported issues with different machines going down and different things like that. But at a very baseline, right, there needs to be a increased attention to the election infrastructure in the United States. And that's not just the machines. That's also the amount of polling locations that are open, the type of polling the early polling locations that might be open, more attention to absentee or mail-in votes. California is actually trying a new system where at least some of the counties in California where you can kind of go to any polling location regardless of where it is to cast your ballot. But I guess one of the things to kind of come back to this idea of voter suppression, one of the things that is going to be increasingly important, particularly as we move towards November, is ensuring that these polling locations are open, that the hours are such that people are able to maneuver their schedules to get in and get out. Because waiting for 7 hours with someone who might have kids or might have to go to their shift at work or any number of things it is its own form of
even to go to the bathroom.
Even to
I
go
mean,
to the bathroom.
But you know, and literally getting through a ballot at the polling place can take a long time. So if you think about the ridiculously long lines there were for what was a pretty simple ballot here in the primary, now just triple the amount of time it's going to take to get through the ballot, and how much more time that's going to mean for people waiting in long lines.
Thank you so much. Adam Harris is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Amy Walter hosts Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. She's also national editor of The Cook Political Report.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Today, abortion makes its way back to the Supreme Court. Oral arguments begin in June Medical Services versus Russo, and the stakes are high for reproductive rights. The decision could impact abortion access across the USA. And at the center of this case is something called an admitting privileges law in Louisiana.
Admitting privilege laws require an abortion provider to have privileges or permission to admit a patient into a local hospital.
That's Ushma Upadhyay. She's an epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco. And she says admitting privileges laws first popped up in the early 1980s and regained popularity about a decade ago. Supporters of these laws say they improve patient safety, but critics don't think so.
It was thought up as a way to make it harder for
providers, for physicians to be able to offer abortion care for their patients.
Now, this case is almost identical to a Texas law the Supreme Court struck down 4 years ago. But since then, the Supreme Court has changed. Trump appointees Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh solidified a conservative majority on the bench. This is how Ushma explains what these admitting privileges laws mean for abortion providers and the patients they serve.
Admitting privileges laws sound like common sense, but what it really does is it actually ends up shuttering clinics. Providers often cannot obtain admitting privileges from their local hospital. Sometimes it's because of anti-abortion sentiment within the local hospital, or sometimes it's because to be able to obtain admitting privileges, abortion providers or any kind of provider needs to be able to admit a minimum number of patients. And the issue here is that abortion is so extremely safe that they're not able to achieve the minimum number of admissions to be able to get those hospital admitting privileges.
So that's the irony, because the techniques have been mastered so much that it's highly unlikely that if you go in for an abortion, you're going to need to be admitted. But because of that, it complicates the situation.
That's right. I've been doing research for almost 10 years on the safety of abortion. And in one of our studies, we looked at 55,000 abortions. And among those, less than a quarter of 1% actually resulted in a major complication. So abortion is so extremely safe, and these laws really are not based in any evidence that they are needed.
How does an abortion provider, any doctor for that matter, get admitting privileges?
So they have to submit an application to the local hospital. The hospital board must review the application. They usually review the credentials of the provider. They look at the number of admissions that they've had or tried to refer to the hospital. Looking at all of that, all in all, they make their determination.
The Supreme Court struck down an almost identical admitting privileges law from Texas in 2016. Why are we seeing this Louisiana one before the court again?
The only thing that has changed since that decision is the makeup of the Supreme Court. The states are very similar. Louisiana actually has a lot fewer abortion facilities, so it actually is a more extreme situation and would actually be an even greater burden on Louisiana women because there are so few abortion clinics. Right now, there are three. And if this law were to pass, there would be only one clinic left. When people have to travel very extreme distances, it is an extreme burden on patients.
So should the Supreme Court actually uphold Louisiana's law? In the short and long term, how could this impact abortion access in that state and across the USA?
If this law is passed, it could signal to other states that abortion regulations are acceptable. And it could open the door to much more extreme measures in other states, not just regarding admitting privileges, other laws that regulate abortion out of practice.
Thank you so much. Ushma Upadhyay is an epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco.
Thanks for having me.
Hear now from an abortion provider about what admitting privileges laws mean for her and her patients.
My name is Dr. Yashika Robinson. I am the medical director of Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives in Huntsville, Alabama.
Her clinic is one of three left in Alabama that provide abortions.
As an abortion provider, I am one of the only providers in the state that has hospital admitting privileges.
Dr. Robinson explained why there are so few providers with this privilege in the state.
The constant attacks that we face as abortion care providers, it discourages other healthcare professionals from going into the field. My clinic has very hostile anti-abortion protesters outside the doors every single day. They target not only me, they target my staff and my patients, with their goal being to discourage patients from coming to my practice.
So you mentioned the social stigma that surrounds abortion in Alabama. Aside from that, are there any other major barriers to getting these admitting privileges?
There's real restrictions to abortion providers being able to get hospital admitting privileges. It's important to keep in mind that privileges is just that. It's a privilege. It's not our right. It doesn't have anything to do with the qualifications of the abortion provider. It's just the fact that hospitals have no incentive to grant an abortion provider privileges.
How did you slip through the cracks?
I wouldn't say that it's slipping through the cracks. I'm a very well-qualified physician. I've not had a problem with poor patient outcomes, haven't had a problem with patient complaints. I am trained as a surgeon and as an abortion provider. The only difference is that with me, I have a local patient population, and I'm one of the few people who is willing to deal with the day-to-day hostility of providing abortion care in the same community where I work. Mm-hmm. Many abortion providers travel in. And so when you think about hospital admitting privileges, you have to understand that hospitals can set arbitrary criteria in order for a physician to qualify. Those things being things like you have to live within 30 minutes of the hospital. For me as an OBGYN, they require that I have a certain amount of deliveries within a 24-month time frame. And another thing that is very important to keep in mind is that you also, for most every hospital, you have to have what's called a covering physician. That means another physician who is willing to support your application for admitting privileges to that hospital. That physician would be responsible for covering for your patients in the event that you were sick or if you had to leave town for something like a funeral. When I applied for privileges in the Huntsville area, I went through a list of about 45 to 50 OBGYNs. I could only find one person that was willing to stand up and say, I will be your backup or covering physician.
Some of your patients come from nearby states, right? They're not just Alabama.
Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives serves patients from five states. We see patients from Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Many of these patients travel to our areas because of TRAP laws, these targeted regulations against abortion providers that have forced providers in their area to no longer be able to provide the services that they need in their community.
What would an admitting privileges law mean for the patients with whom you work? How would it change that population's life?
An admitting privilege law would harm our patients dearly because it would shut down clinics, and therefore patients would have less access to care. When you have fewer providers that are able to provide the care, patients have to travel further and further. So you can understand that there are going to be several patients that will not even be able to access the care that they need. We know that this is going to fall hardest on patients that are low income already, people of color, young patients, immigrant patients, people in rural communities. And these are people who are already facing so many barriers.
I imagine this takes an emotional toll on providers like yourself. How are you feeling as the Supreme Court prepares to revisit this issue?
You know, as an abortion provider, you often feel isolated and feel ostracized, but it's the passion that we have for our patients and the knowledge that we have knowing how important these services are that pushes us and forces us to get up every single day, to go to these legislative hearings, to travel where we need to travel, to get to the patients who need us.
Dr. Ishika Robinson is the medical director of Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives. Ishika, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've been looking into a number of questions surrounding the 2020 census over the last few weeks, and we've been checking in on what different community leaders across the country are doing to prevent undercounts in their areas. Today, we focus on Native Americans living on tribal lands. During the last census, they were the most undercounted of any demographic group.
Back in 2000, the undercount was less than 1%, and in 2010, the undercount was near 5%, I believe it was 4.9%. This is Arben Mitchell. Greetings from the Great Navajo Nation, Wind Rock, Arizona.
Arben is a Census Bureau Tribal Partnership Specialist for the Navajo Nation. He's also the area census manager for Window Rock, Arizona. For the past two decades, he's been working on census outreach efforts. But for certain tribal communities, it's challenging to get an accurate count. Mistrust of the federal government and a lack of internet connectivity also contribute to the problem. Another source of confusion is how to properly note tribal affiliation. In 2010, members of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma experienced this issue on a massive scale.
This is Bradley Gernand. I'm Senior Communications Specialist for the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
Bradley says that during the previous census, over 150,000 Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma members wrote in phrases that were not accepted by the Census Bureau.
So they might have used a couple or three different phrases or words. They might have said Choctaw, Choctaw Indian, Choctaw Nation. And then in addition to those 159,000, 24,000 of them wrote in Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. So the Census Bureau only counted the 24,000 who wrote in Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. So for the past 10 years, for many purposes, the federal government considers us, for grants and things like that, to be a tribe of 24,000 individuals. These days, our population's at roughly 226,000.
This time around, leaders from the Choctaw Nation worked to make sure they didn't have a repeat of 2010.
Our chief has been very much in the lead on this one, and he negotiated with the Census Bureau director probably in about October or November. He wrote to the director and said, "You didn't count this in 2010, but in 2020, would you count the words Choctaw Nation as being Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma?" And Dr. Dillingham wrote back and said, "Yes, we would." So we were very pleased by that. And so then, you know, as of about November, we knew what we should instruct our tribal members to write in.
When I spoke with Arvin and Bradley, Bradley shared how the 2010 undercount financially impacted the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
We didn't understand here the causal link, if you will, between the number of individuals who submit census forms each 10 years and the amount of federal dollars that are made available to the communities or the societies where they live. We are only just figuring this out now. So in our case, we started looking at the case of one particular grant. I think in 2019, we asked for a grant. We competed for it within the federal government for money that would help mitigate domestic violence. And we anticipated receiving $1.2 million. When the money came, it was only in the amount of about $200,000. When we pushed back and asked why we got the smaller amount, we were told by the funding agency that there are only 24,000 Choctaws, so that's what you get. So we were horrified. And then when we started looking at the big picture and trying to figure out, well, what's the financial hit over the past 10 years? We couldn't even get to the bottom of it. But we know based on that one grant, which is just one grant out of many grants we receive each year, multiplied by 10, the financial damage has been significant. And that's why the entire tribe is mobilizing to try to address this issue.
Arvin, you've been working for two decades on census efforts. This year, the Census Bureau has introduced more digital elements. Will that create any potential issues for the Navajo Nation?
I know the challenge is out there because we're not the connectivity isn't good as you further go out into the rural area. So responding by internet is probably a challenge. And then, of course, responding by phone might still be a challenge. So back to responding with the paper might be the better way to respond. And then if one doesn't respond in those three ways, and then, of course, the census worker in May will be coming back to do the interview.
What about language barriers? Is there language barriers for both the Choctaw and the Navajo when it comes to census workers collecting information?
I know that for Navajo, we still have our elderlies out there that don't understand or write the English language. So we recruited over 3,000, and I don't know what the percentage is. Of those recruits, some still talk Navajo. They understand the Navajo language. So during our training, if we have a Navajo-speaking individual or a person that understands Navajo, we really want to utilize those people to get into the rural areas.
So, Arvin, you know, there is a lot of mistrust between the U.S. federal government and tribal citizens. Do you think that that is creating an issue when it comes to actually filling out the census?
For Indian country, the majority, you know, that's probably still there, the mistrust of government. We did a lot of education on Navajo, like what we covered the first part. You know, we got most of our money is from the federal government, and we have to tell them that, you know, your account is confidential. Your information that you give us is confidential. And, you know, I think a lot of folks still think that those answers will be used against them. So a lot of education. We did a lot of education when we did the 20,000 count and then the 2010. You know, every 10 years, I think Navajo is starting to really understand the importance of a census count.
So, Brad, finally, How optimistic are you that there will be an accurate count for your tribe in 2020?
We are optimistic because we are doing major efforts to make outreach to all of our tribal citizens, regardless of where they live, anywhere in the United States, and we have them in all 50 states. I think for us, it's going to be probably a success. I worry more, though, our committee worries more about the general society in which we're living. It seems to us when we're out there talking with people that probably there was a change of attitude somehow, and it occurred sometime before the 2010 census, and we didn't realize that. And we've batted around ideas here. We think it may have had something to do with the 2008 Great Recession and all the job losses and that sort of thing that followed from that. Because by the time 2010 rolled around, people in this part of the world simply were not interested in filling out census forms. It suggests to us that the existing construct of the census might need to be reimagined. And fortunately, we've noticed that the Census Bureau itself has floated an idea for 2030 that might bridge these issues. This idea that they're floating notes that, you know, all this information they probably need exists in other federal government databases, such as that owned by the IRS or the Social Security or maybe Medicaid. And they're proposing that Congress fund them to test the idea of pre-populating the 2030 census with this data. And the idea is, in 2030, instead of conducting the census on the basis of housing units, which is the way it's done now, it would be turned on its head, and it would instead be a count of people. It would identify the people and then place them. And so the beauty of it, it seems to us, is that on April 1st, 2030, which would be the kickoff day for the 2030 census, the census would open and would already be 90% complete. The remaining 10% would require footwork to identify indigents and other people who are difficult to identify.
Thank you so much. Arben Mitchell is a Census Bureau Tribal Partnership Specialist for the Navajo Nation, and Brad Gernan is the Senior Communications Specialist for the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. You can hear all of our coverage of the census at thetakeaway.org/2020census. That's it for you and me today. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. And if you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.